Welcome, 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 welcome back. This is BTSC's podcast, Meeting You Where You Are. I am Chris Simon.
And I'm Jada McCray.
Jada, today is the day I've been telling you about. Today, Jada's outnumbered today. We always have this Morgan State versus Coppin State battle. Then we have this University of Maryland versus Morgan State battle.
I want y'all to bear with me while I demonstrate a great degree of grace today.
Jada's already outnumbered. I have my gray and red on, and our special guest has her gray and red on. We were taking the light.
If y'all don't hear a lot from me, it's because I'm biting my tongue.
No, we want you to be as boisterous and outspoken as you typically are. We want to give you your, we want your best today. I've gotten tired of this. I said we're going to defend this thing. You try to talk about our interns. You try to say this, then the third. We ready.
You ready?
We ready.
Okay.
We want that action today.
All right.
Oh no, I'm just kidding. I'm not kidding though. But we have a special guest, being that it's the conclusion of Social Work Month. I thought it would be only appropriate, being that I still have relationships at my schools that I graduated from.
I donate.
I have physical attachments and relationships with the school I graduated from.
I have physical relationships and attachments to BTST.
Thank you. But I have physical relationships with the school I graduated from. So I was like, what better way to end off Social Work Month than to get the university,
look at you, Freudian slip. Freudian.
To get Morgan State University School of Social Work best people here. Mm-hmm. And so we've done that today. That is my
alma mater.
And that is a place that I currently hold a position at that I won't gloat about just yet in front of Jada. I only do
sure
it like every podcast,
I was
right?
Say it doesn't stop you any other time.
I only say it like every
it
podcast.
Would only be right.
I know. But this is not about me right now. And it's about the university and it's about social workers. And I guess I'm going to tell you this funny story before I introduce her. When she first came to the old office on York Road, she walked through, she says, "This is nice, but there are too many LCPCs here. You need some social workers." She's like, "I'm not saying anything bad about the LCPCs, but you need social workers." And so I think that we have improved on that.
Yes.
Not saying that we're discriminatory upon anybody who likes to practice therapy.
No, we have plenty of LCPCs, but we do have a lot of
But we have a ton of social workers. Mm-hmm. And so today our guest is Dr. Linda Darrow from the Morgan State University School of Social Work. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well.
Welcome.
How are you?
I'm excited. I'm excited. So, Dr. Darrow, can you give our listeners some of your background and how you, just background about who you are and what you currently do?
Okay. I am currently an assistant professor in the School of Social Work in the master's program. I have been at Morgan for... feels like forever, actually. I started at Morgan actually as an adjunct instructor, and that was in 2003, and continued to pursue my own education. I have a undergraduate degree from State University of New York at Stony Brook in social work. I have a graduate degree from Virginia Commonwealth University, and I have a PhD from Smith College School for Social Work, all of which were PWIs. Mm. And I've worked in PWI institutions most of my career. I've always had a desire to teach, and have always had a desire to teach in a school where I felt I was really going to be valued and what I brought to the table would be valued. Mm. The door opened for me to come into Morgan as an adjunct, and upon meeting our dean, Dean Anna McFadder at that time, the one question I asked her is, what do I need to do to be able to teach at this level? And she said, you have to go back to school. And I said, okay. And that's what I did. Mm. So I've been at Morgan now since 2003. I've been on faculty since 2007. And that's where I hope to remain.
And outside of being a social worker and a professor, You also are a, I want to make sure I use the right word, reverend pastor?
I'm a minister. Licensed minister.
See, that's what happened. I haven't been here for a while, right? Yes. I thought you, she always hits me and says, I haven't seen you at church. I'm like, I'm watching online.
He's one of those bedside Baptists.
Bedside Baptists. No, honestly, my son, we were just having this conversation. My youngest son, Jada, you know Christian, and he can be a handful. And he's loud when he doesn't sit well for a long period of time. He's loud. And so when we would come, I would wind up having to take, because we like to sit up front and be, to get the whole, like somewhere close to the front. So you,
you know,
the
Holy Spirit is throughout the whole church. It does
it's not saying. Hey, I need to be as close as possible. I need to be in that number.
He said when the anointing falls. Yes,
I need to be close. I need more than most people. So so I got to be close.
They're going to look up. You're going to be sitting on the altar.
I need to be as close as possible. My son starts screaming, and so I wound up having to take him out to the little lounge area. And when you watch the whole thing on the TV, and there's other babies in there screaming.
Yeah.
I'm like, if I'm going to watch this on the TV with babies screaming,
might as well do it.
I might not want to be around 10 babies screaming, and I could watch the same thing at home.
Yeah. Because we have small kids in church.
Yeah. Our church is set up where you can watch it from wherever, you know? So it's like, don't blame me for taking advantage of the technological advances that we have.
Listen, praise God for the live stream. I feel the same way. I understand.
Exactly.
So, but Dr. Darrell is also a minister there. And how did you get into that?
That was a God move.
Yeah.
That was a God move. I've always, I love the Lord, and I enjoy being in church. I enjoy working as a servant in church. And I just think for me, it was really just listening and being obedient. It wasn't something that I think I willingly did for a while. I just kind of sat back on it for a minute. But God will have his way. Mm. And he did. And I, you know, that's where I am.
You bring it
into everything.
Yeah, yeah. You have a lot, and you do. If you know Dr. Darrell, like she embodies so much, and she gives you so much. Like I've had one of her classes, and we'll get to that. But she just gives you so much. She has so much to offer. I always speak very highly, and I can always get excited when I get to be in her presence or get to speak with her. But tell people about how you got into social work. What did you? You know, we like to say social workers aren't made, they're born. Was it the same for you?
I think it was. I just, I wanted to teach. I knew as a little girl I wanted to teach.
And where are you from?
Originally, I'm from Long Island, New York.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And people will ask me that question, and they look at me and say, you don't have a New York accent.
When you said Long Island, you just did.
Yes. It's still there. It's still there. But I've always wanted to teach, and as a little girl, I would just play teacher. I had teachers in my family. I had an uncle. I have an uncle and an aunt who both were educators. And those models really impacted me, and I know they impact others. But I knew very clearly, even as a little girl, that I didn't want to teach in a high school or an elementary school. I wanted to teach in a college, and I had no idea why. There was no one in my family who had taught at that level, but there were certainly educators. I had an uncle who was an engineer. So for many members of my family, education has always been a priority. That was something you knew you were going to do. And for them to achieve what they achieved when they did, at the time that they did, for African Americans, that was exceptional. So I just continued going to school. I knew that on some level, I knew I wanted to do work with in a hospital. Didn't want to be a nurse. Didn't want to do any of that, you know, messy medical stuff. But I knew that being in a hospital and wanting to teach, for some reason, just kind of
it spoke to you.
Came together and it spoke to me. So when the doors opened for me to be able to do that, I started working as a manager, mid-level manager at the State University of New York at Stony Brook, their university hospital, when it initially opened up. And I worked in the burn, which is the burn unit, which was then a small regional burn unit.
You can hit a small now, right? You hit in New York when she say small.
But, you know, all of that experience kind of brought me into wanting to work with people who were really in distress. Mm-hmm. Patients who would come into the hospital, you would see their families really struggling with the things that they were having to deal with, the change in their lives because a family member was ill. What that meant not only for the patient, but what it meant for the family. Mm-hmm. And just having a desire to be able to help people to manage whatever those transitions were for them. So just kind of, it just was a natural progression for mm-hmm. me. I went to State University of New York at Stony Brook and was in their undergraduate program for social work. And at that time, community-based social work was really the big deal. It mm-hmm. was really the big
deal. And you didn't even need a license and all that other stuff at that time.
You needed license, but it wasn't as stringent mm-hmm. Then as I'm not dating myself. I will not tell you my age.
Now, mind you, you would never be able to tell how old Dr. Daryl is anyway. But she has this beautiful gray hair. But outside of that, I think she dyed it that way. Just for like that distinguished look. Just for the distinguished look. No. But you would never be able to tell just in person, by the way.
But so, you know, the rules and regulations certainly, you know, became more stringent over time. Licensure was something that needed to happen. Mm-hmm. People needed to be trained and qualified to work with the different populations and groups and communities and organizations that they were going into. I had the experience, and I really value it, to be able to not only learn how to do community-based social work, but organization, community org, and that, you know, that level, it was really macro level mm-hmm. social work. When I graduated from Stony Brook, I took a position as a director of a youth organization and stayed in that position for a couple of years, but continued to want to be in the hospital. Mm-hmm. But it was very difficult. It wasn't easy, particularly for African Americans, to move into those positions. Those positions would be held onto by folks who were there for years. Mm-hmm. And for you to be able to get a foot in the door was nothing short of miraculous. Mm. I left Long Island and I moved actually here to Baltimore in the mid 80s and took a position as the director for patient services at, there was a healthcare center that used to be on the corner of St. Paul and Mount Vernon. It was connected with what was then Francis Scott Key Medical Center, which is now Bayview.
Mm. Okay.
That medical center really serviced a large population.
So were you just working in, like, outpatient, just regular services, or was it, like, were you in, like, the mental health psychiatric unit at that time?
It was actually a combination.
Mm. Okay.
So it was, you know, medical services, outpatient medical services, and we would do referrals for mental health services. Mm. We weren't doing a lot of direct mental health care in that center.
So is the hospital, is that where your passion ultimately is or was mm-hmm. at that time?
Medical social work was really where I wanted to be. Mm.
There's a lot of people who don't know that there are so many different facets that you can get into as social workers.
Exactly.
A lot of people think social workers sometimes are just your DSS worker or something mm-hmm. like that, but they don't know that you're a therapist or social workers, that they're policy, that yes. they're business, that you know, that you have business managers who are mm-hmm. from a social work. Then you mm-hmm. also have hospitals. Then you have the older population that gerontology that you could work with. Dang, Jada, I know the word. You didn't have to try to jump in there. Jada's trying to make sure that she's trying to show how clinically she is and what the University of Maryland taught her.
I'm not trying. Earlier, I had to give you the definition for a cornucopia. I was trying to help you out.
That sounds like a piece of fruit.
Actually, no.
Well, don't judge me.
But it holds fruit.
That's what I told him.
Well, listen, I didn't learn that at University. At Morgan State. So whatever. So from there, from the hospital, then you came to the school?
Yeah.
Morgan?
Actually, it was prior to that, I worked in Virginia.
Okay.
Because I was doing my master's at VCU, and I worked at Chippenham Medical Center. Now, that's when I realized how narrow the profession was for African Americans. Mm. I had a position at Chippenham Medical Center, first as a trainer for people who were learning how to be unit secretaries. And I kept applying for a position as a social worker, and I must have applied for that position at least three different times. And each time I applied for it, the first time I applied for it, they said that I wasn't quite qualified for the position because I had not done hospital social work per se. I had worked in the hospitals and I had done hospital management, mm-hmm. which is why they hired me as the trainer for unit secretaries, but I hadn't done direct social work. But I applied for the position again, and I applied for the position again. And the third time I applied for the position, the doors opened and I got it.
You know, I'm so happy that you're mm-hmm. shining a light on this, because people would think that generally with social workers, we're normally we're thought to be anywhere, like to think of ourselves as an inclusive group. But to hear that there was systemic racism in the social work yes. field, it still is to this day.
Yes.
But I mean, I think it's really good that you are showing mm-hmm. people and you're telling people your story so people know mm-hmm. that there are barriers for us as well.
Exactly. And, you know, when I was growing up, I was always told that you had to be, you couldn't be as good as, mm-hmm. you had to be better than mm-hmm. those folks that you were competing against, because the doors were not going to open for you as easily as they would open for, you know, other folks. So I did get the position, and there were people who would literally, people in housekeeping, people in maintenance, in the service professions in the hospital would stop me in the hallway. They were primarily African American, would stop me in the hallways of the hospital to congratulate me. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I don't understand what is the big deal? And one woman said to me one day, she said, you don't understand. She said, you are the first African American social worker they've ever hired in this hospital. Mm-hmm. You are the first African-American woman who has held a management-level position in this hospital.
Wow.
And you have no idea how that makes us feel. Mm-hmm. I felt like I had stepped back in time.
Yeah.
But I always carried that and always felt like I have a responsibility.
You're ambassador for the culture.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Ambassador for our, you know, for our people. Mm-hmm. We are responsible for representing ourselves mm-hmm. and for doing the best that we can at whatever it is that we choose to do. My chosen profession was social work. I had the opportunity to get into hospital social work, medical social work, and I've never really turned back from that. When I graduated from VCU, I applied for an internship. I had, and Jada, you know this, you have to do your clinical internships, mm-hmm. and I had applied for three of them. Two of them were in D.C., one was in child welfare, one was in working with a program for AIDS in D.C., and the other one was at Johns Hopkins. And very honestly, I didn't think I would get the one at
Johns
Hopkins. They
sound a lot better than my internships. Maybe you were more qualified.
You're funny. But I got the internship at Hopkins, mm-hmm. and I left Virginia and came back up to Baltimore. My internship was at the Children's Specialty Care Clinic in the Outpatient Center, and I was working with children and families, children who had cystic fibrosis, children who had diabetes and sickle cell anemia. And however challenging it was also, I think, very, it was a broadening experience. It allowed me not only to work with the children and understand where they were in their own process of having these serious medical conditions and how they were managing these things at different developmental stages and what this meant to them and how they experienced them, but working with the families to help families understand what was happening and support them in their process.
So I thought always thought like, well, families was one of your biggest passions. Is that still true? Okay. Because so I'm listening to this story evolve and I'm like, so I took Dr. Darrell for human behavior. I'm like, how does this story lead me to this? But then once you start talking about the evaluations, the psychosocials and how you work with the families, I'm like, that's where I learned my first psychosocial evaluation. So I'm starting to see how all this came to be. So when you got to Morgan, did you start off teaching human behavior or were you teaching stuff more like from a...
When I first came to Morgan, I taught intro to social work. I taught generalist methods and practice. And it was a case management course that they had. And I taught that. Then I evolved into HPSE, into teaching human behavior in the social environment, which is a course I still enjoy teaching.
That is one of that was one of my favorite classes. I loved it.
I'm going to say it was one of my. I'm not just saying this because she's sitting right next to me, but this is one of my. That was one of my favorite classes as well. So for a lot of people that don't know Morgan, because I want to stay on the human behavior part, but Morgan has an undergrad, graduate, and a doctorate program. And the different focuses are what? We have urban youth and families.
We have urban youth and families. We have is it child welfare. And we have gerontology. We have macro. We're really beginning to build our macro area. Public health.
I think that was it.
It's so interesting to see how these things come in cycles. You said you're building up macro because when I was in graduate school, there was this big push for us to become clinicians.
Yes.
And I started off as macro and then, you know, it was a really big push for us to become clinicians. And a lot of us focused on the clinical aspect. But now the way that society is changing, it's becoming really clear that there has to be a lot of macro involvement for people, not only for social, but for people who understand human behavior and understand systems. If you have a really good grasp of that, your involvement is necessary.
Not only systems, but policies.
And policy, yes.
We need to really be very present in terms of being able to develop policy, being able to understand how policy impacts not only practice, but how policy impacts communities and how communities then impact individuals. So it's a bottom-up and top-down type of approach. Like you, when I started out, macro was...
Hold on, you can't make too many reference to her because she went to University of Maryland, so you can't keep saying like you.
To be fair, at the time, Morgan didn't have an accredited master's program. That program came after I graduated. So don't act like I don't rep HBCUs.
I'm just saying.
All right, don't do that. Don't do that.
And you went to Coppin.
Yes, I did. In HBCU, I'm an Eagle.
Right.
And we're, so some, and we're a bear.
What I was saying was when I started out macro. And I went into micro because micro was being really promoted because they were looking for clinicians, people to do individual practice. The macro piece started to fall off when you actually started seeing the disintegration of large mental health institutions and larger institutions that provided services on a broader scale. When those institutions started to really kind of be cut back on, then they started looking at community-based services where macro still fit very well, but the money wasn't there.
So just for our audience, just so you understand that once upon a time in Maryland in particular, we had a lot of mental, institutions where people who were mentally ill would live in these institutions for long periods of time. Mm-hmm. So push came to then integrate them into society and have them be treated within the community. There's been a mixed bag review about how that's working out so far.
Because those community services, although they may have been set up with all intention of helping folks make that transition, mm-hmm. those community services and agencies, I don't believe, were funded mm-hmm. at the level that they needed to be funded. People did not really invest mm-hmm. in supporting those programs. And to a very large degree, and it still exists today, people have a very discriminatory mm-hmm. Approach to mental health.
Yes.
Mental health is not, you know, is still mm-hmm. not an area that is embraced as it should be.
Mm-hmm.
Individuals, and particularly within the within our communities, mm-hmm. within African American communities, mental health services are not services that people will actively seek out.
True.
So I don't believe that the services were offered on a broad enough base, on an inclusive enough mm-hmm. basis. And when you're providing services, it can't just be medication.
Mm-hmm. That's why when Chris suggested that we do the podcast, and he was really pushing, because I'm a clinician all day long, mm-hmm. I'm in management all day long, and for me, I'm like, oh no, we just provide the services. But when he said, let's do a podcast so that people really understand the services that we provide and the need for mental health, so we can mm-hmm. normalize it, so that people can understand
exactly
that, you know, mental health, all of us should be concerned with it.
Exactly.
And even like in our blog, thank you, Jade, for the Once in a Blue Moon shout out. But in addition to that, like on our blog, we post articles I was just showing you about different things related to mental health, physical, and the community.
Mm-hmm.
And like two of the articles recently have been about two NBA players who've reached, mm-hmm. who've opened up and start talking about mental health. And even one thing that I want to do, we're celebrating our 10-year anniversary this year.
Mm-hmm.
And so
amazing.
As far as our anniversary, I want to produce this short film. And I'm hoping to have it on Netflix and stuff. It's going to be mm-hmm. about like the stigma related to mental health as far as African American men. And I want to have like a whole barbershop, without giving out the whole storyline,
mm-hmm.
have a
Don't
whole barbershop place.
Don't give other people a chance to snatch your idea. It's a good idea.
Well, they can't do it better than us anyway.
Bye.
But literally, it's going to be that whole thing talking about how men have this stigma as related, not just men, but we're going to focus it on the men and then mm-hmm. spread it out from there. And just talking about, like, Jay-Z's opened up recently that him and his wife go to counseling, that he's been into it, and how he's mm-hmm. learning about the manifestation of hurt, the behavior mm-hmm. that people are displaying, the anger, but it's really mm-hmm. rooted in hurt.
Exactly.
And then Jada also does, like, this thing where she goes to, like, some beauty salons with the Black Mental Health Alliance and talks about mental health.
Mm-hmm.
So trying to bring mental health to a meeting you where you are, you know, bringing it to you, letting you know that, like, mm-hmm. disarming you, letting you know that this is a normal thing, that this is a practice that everyone should be in. You can never, therapist should be in it, because you can't be a therapist unless you've been in therapy mm-hmm. before.
One of the things that I know you've heard me say in class, and I'll tell students all the time, how can you expect to help other people do their work if you've not done yours?
You mentioned class, and it makes me wonder, how was Chris as a student?
Ah, I knew this was coming. Here's the thing.
I can only imagine.
I have to remind them that I'm also a licensed therapist, because they see me in the macro business creative space a lot. You know, Jada always says that you're a visionary, you're this, that, and the third.
Don't tell people
but
then that I say stuff
but
like
then
that.
But then I have to remind them, like, I'm also a clinician as well. So we'll be in meetings, and I'll just drop a word, and they'll be like, oh, what do you know?
Look at you.
Come on now. Like,
he was a good student.
Mm-hmm.
He was a challenging student.
I can imagine.
But he was a good student. Chris is who he is, and that's the one thing I think I really value mm-hmm. about him. He has not changed. When he stepped into my classroom the first time, one of the things that Chris said to me was, I want to open a business. And I asked, I said, well, what kind of business, you know, are you interested in opening up? I want to open a PRP. I want to do this. I want to. He had these enormous dreams, and he brought them into the room. And I said, okay, well, before we do any of that, you got to pass HPSI.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to
we have to
get the fundamentals. Mm-hmm. And he was a persistent student. He was there. He was present. He did what he needed to do.
Insert butt.
Yeah.
You don't have to tell me. No,
it was a challenge.
No, honestly, you got to think about it. So when I came to my undergrad was in business, mm-hmm. business marketing. Mm-hmm. And so I had a clothing store at the time. And so a lot of my buddies were they had got into social work and they went back to get their master's. And I was doing very well with my clothing store at the time. And I was just very ignorant, you know, from a perspective where I just didn't know, and I thought that I knew and stuff like that. So they're like, you should go back to get your social work, go to Morgan. We got this person that's going, this person that's going, this person that's going. And I'm like, I'm not trying to go back there, man. I'm doing pretty good financially the way I'm doing right now. Oh, plus I was also working at other agencies on the side, like working with kids on like a mentor and PRP perspective. I was working at three other places. So I'm like, why do I need to go back? I make enough money now and I'm good. Like, I'm not trying to evoke more education and studying on myself. So when I finally decided to go, I'm like, all right, I'm going to go. And so I came with this, I guess this...
Pompous.
Yeah, pompous. This attitude is like, I'm only here so I learn how to do this so I can do this more, do something mm-hmm. else more. Just teach, put me...
What you going to teach me?
Exactly. And that's the kind of way that it... And that's the kind of way that it was. And, you know, and I'm so blessed that I've had Dr. Darrell as one of my first professors, and that I appreciate the New Yorkness in her mm-hmm. because I'm coming in unsubstantive, you know, from a social work perspective. Mm-hmm. And here's somebody that has this extensive background who's broken down barriers, which I've learned mm-hmm. about today, and just coming in with so much. And you have this standoff, you know, it's mm-hmm. her classroom and I'm the student. And she had to humble me, you know, mm-hmm. and had to really humble. And I'm blessed and thankful for that. For this day, you know, mm-hmm. she had this New York thing and just, I'm not stepping down. Almost like, I'll meet you outside after this class if you really want it, you know?
She is a lovely lady, guys.
But I was like, whoa, you know? And it was like that mother mm-hmm. where you have that clash with your mom and mm-hmm. but you learn to respect her and you never go there again. Mm-hmm. And she did that. And from that class, I've learned so many key things that has helped me, not even just in the practice mm-hmm. space, but just in handling life in general, mm-hmm. but then also a business. If I just think about like eco maps and how your systems work together mm-hmm. and understanding human behavior is literally one of my favorite classes. That and I really did like chemical dependency.
Mm-hmm.
Human behavior, it helps you learn how to work with people in so many different facets.
It does.
You're able to identify how this person operates, why they may operate mm-hmm. that way, and what you need to do and how you need to fit in mm-hmm. and just learn your different teaching models. What mm-hmm. type of person are you? And I take that eclectic approach, you mm-hmm. know? Like, I know I'm not set in one direction and just rigid, and this is mm-hmm. how things are going to be. I'm very diplomatic and stuff like that. So learning human behavior helps me identify to be able to work with direct staff.
Mm-hmm.
It helps me be able to work with other CEOs. Understanding systems helps further the vision that I've had for the company of understanding here's what's happening in this world from a macro perspective, right? Mm-hmm. Here's where technology is leading us to. Here's where policy and all these other things are leading us to. Here's where we currently are. And I always say social work was and it's progressing, but not as fast as I think that it should, but it's obsolete. It operates from an obsolete model, and we learned about the traditional paradigms versus alternative mm-hmm. paradigms.
One of the things I did in class recently, and actually it was just the other day, I can't just go to the movie and just watch a movie.
Neither can I.
Watch a movie. You know, I mean, I really can't. Mm-hmm. I'm sitting there, and I'm watching this, and I'm like, okay, so what is this about, and what does this mean? I recently went to see the movie Black Panther.
Mm.
And I sat I sat through all of the endings.
Mm-hmm.
So can I tell you something before you finish the story?
Mm-hmm.
You're talking to Black Panther people.
We love
I love the movie. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. Jada, like, Do you know Jada bought her whole family costumes and dashikis, and they went and they were throwing rose petals as they were walking into the theater.
Oh my
and
God.
Sat right there. They looked like the twice. Whole Coming to America. They had the whole Coming to America feel.
Well, I do want to go back and see it again. Yeah. But I watched all three of the endings, and
three endings.
It's you'd have to go back. So the first ending was mm-hmm. when the movie stopped.
You have to sit through
and
the credits.
And you sit through the mm-hmm. credits. And then there's another ending.
Mm-hmm. There is?
Yes.
And then you sit through the credits. Mm-hmm. And then there is another ending.
That's typical of Marvel movies. They usually give you a little egg or Easter egg.
I did not know
so,
that.
So mm-hmm. the question I asked the students who went to see the movie
and stayed.
Was, which and stayed, which ending would you have selected? Mm-hmm. First of all, they looked at me with this deer caught in headlights look. Which ending? What are you talking about? I said, there were three endings.
The way I'm looking at you now.
Okay, right. Mm-hmm. Three endings. Go back and watch it and sit through the entire credits, all of that. There was one ending, and see, then I'm going to end it telling you, but there's a choice, and we all have a choice. They laid out these endings, and you have to understand that each of these endings is very significant mm-hmm. to where we are
and where
we could be.
Absolutely.
Where we might be going, what direction. Sit through the endings mm-hmm. and think about what does this speak to in terms of who we are, where we are, and where are we going, and how are we going to get there. I'm not going to share the endings because there are people who have
we
not...
We can talk off.
Right, off our yeah. mic. But that's what I like to do. There's nothing that is off limits in terms of being able to get students to think about where they are, where they see themselves, and how they're going to get mm-hmm. there. I will take students to plays. One of the courses that I teach is psychopathology and clinical intervention.
You know they don't think we teach that at Morgan, right?
I know. I know.
You know, the University of Maryland say, do y'all even take, do y'all even know the DSM? Do y'all know that?
I'm like, who says this? Who are these foes in your head? Who are these?
Everybody from University of Maryland.
They, everybody,
you,
all of
you
us.
Know that's,
everybody
you know that's
that graduated.
Statement. You know that's a statement.
One of the things that I do with that course to make it real, to bring you into what the course is talking about, it's not just learning how to use the DSM. That's part mm-hmm. of the problem. Mm-hmm. Because we are sticking labels on people mm-hmm. that you don't remove. So once you stick a diagnosis mm-hmm. on an individual, that diagnosis is there.
Absolutely.
You don't go back and remove the diagnosis, mm-hmm. you go back and add another diagnosis. Mm-hmm. So then you end up getting people with a page long of these different mental health diagnoses being treated medicinally for them, mm-hmm. or hopefully they're getting some other supportive care, but
is why it has to be done in a very thoughtful manner. And done with intention and mm-hmm. done with a clear understanding of what symptomology and what symptoms are before you give someone a diagnosis. One thing I cannot stand, careless diagnosis.
Well, insurances push that.
Yeah.
I mean, they really do because they want the diagnosis mm-hmm. within 24, 48 hours, yeah. 72 hours of you seeing the client. How the client presents to me mm-hmm. today
may be very different.
May be very different than how the client is going to present to me tomorrow or the day after. Mm-hmm. But again, I'm going to kind of set that to the side for a moment. In order to get people to understand the reality of what mental health is, what I like to do is to take students out of the classroom. Let's go see what it looks mm-hmm. like. So there have been several plays at different theaters around, and I will take students to see a play mm-hmm. that speaks to mental health issues mm-hmm. and then bring them back and let's talk about what does that look like mm-hmm. for you? What did you get from that? Mm-hmm. And then let's take a look at these symptoms. Mm-hmm. Reading a symptom on a piece of paper.
Very different than the experience
of it. And seeing mm-hmm. a symptom. Helping people to understand what have you seen when you do a genogram of your family, Or if you do, depending on which method you use, I mean, we can either do something very in-depth or something rather, you know, surface. But depending on how deep you want to go with it, you begin to discover who in your family line has had mental health problems. They call it, I've had the blues, or I've had, you know, these long-term chronic conditions, alcoholism, all of this stuff that we need to understand causes long-term effects, not only for the individual, but for the family.
In the community.
And exactly. And it extends into the community.
Can I interject right there? So that was going to be one thing that I was going to also outline that has been like one of the most impactful thing that we've done in the class. When we did the genogram, I was able to, and I tried to go a little bit more in depth with mine. So I was able to, it was astonishing being that I don't have a relationship with my biological dad. I have a stepdad, right? But when I had to do research and find out about my biological dad, seeing that his break, he had a daughter first. I had a daughter first. That relationship with that daughter mom didn't work. My relationship with my daughter mom didn't work. Then he had another, you know, he got married again, which I also did. But also just seeing some of the behaviors, like seeing the things that he was into are very much present in me. And then seeing just my uncles and my aunts and just seeing how all of these people and the way that they thought and the way that they were raised influenced the way that I've been conditioned and the way that I've learned and the way that I'm raised. And it goes on to the way that I'm teaching my kids. And my wife and I, we go to family therapy as well. And that was one of the things that she's did to try to tie in those connections about why you do the things you do, where you've learned these things, how have you identified, like for marriage, where's your perception of education of marriage, where are your expectations coming from? But then you look at your genogram, you see this was an unsuccessful marriage, this was an unsuccessful marriage, this was. So maybe you're basing your idea of a marriage off things that aren't really.
That didn't work because you didn't know anything different.
Exactly.
So learning, using those kinds of tools helps you to identify where certain issues might be, but it also helps you to understand that you can change those things.
Yes.
That they don't have to continue to perpetuate themselves.
Yeah. One of the things I also, sorry to cut you off again, but after seeing Black Panther, I'm just excited, I'm sorry. After seeing Black Panther, I came back with a sense of wanting to have some type of diaspora, you know, wanting to know, like, I have, I said this on one of my podcasts before, I just came from my buddy's Jewish, he's Jewish, it was his wedding this weekend, it was in Arizona, right? And this was my first time, like I've seen it in the movies where they step on the glass, everybody screams Mazel Tov. I was so excited to do that, and then we picked them up in a chair and did the thing, you know, it was just fun, you know? But they have a sense of culture that they have these norms and these rituals that they do consistently. Yes. And then I have my brothers that are Nigerian or whatever, and then they have their sense of norms and garbs that they wear today. But me, as an African American man, I don't have those same rituals. I would love to know, like, hey, where did I come from? Not just in Africa, but what part, what tribe, what are the norms? So me and Jada joke around it, and I've talked to Janine about that. I'm going to do AfricanAncestry.com or something like that.
I keep saying the same thing.
But honestly, we do. I think that we've been oppressed. You've been taught that the things that we do and the traditions that African Americans
have. She's about to go
to
the fried chicken and watermelon.
No, but seriously, it's not because it's not a source of shame. But we've been taught that the traditions that we have are a source of shame, so we don't want to embrace them.
Exactly.
If they've been allowed to develop and we could just love them and appreciate them for what they are. Like the cookout, like fried chicken and all of those
things. Greens versus kale.
Think about it like this. When they have African American History Month, if a university puts that on the menu, there's an uproar and there's a cry that it's racism. But if we see it as something that we hold and we cherish, if we don't allow it to be something that's mocked, then we can appreciate that. I'm very appreciative of African American.
If we stop doing things for a month or a week and saying, oh, well, this is African American month. So does that mean for the other 11 months of the year, I don't exist?
It's 365
it's 365 days
a year.
A year. So to be able to integrate into the overall culture all of my value, then I begin to feel like I am included. I have to learn, and I say I in terms of a collective I, I have to learn that there is more to me than just what someone else identifies for me. Mm-hmm. I have to find out what that is for myself. Mm-hmm. Go back, watch the movie, watch the endings, mm-hmm. because those endings will speak to you in terms of, so now what are the next steps? How do we recapture mm-hmm. who we are and then transmit that information to those coming behind us? One of the things that we tend not to do as much as we may have done decades in the past is we don't speak to our elders. Mm-hmm. We don't find out from them what is your history. Mm-hmm. One of the ways you do a genogram is to talk to somebody, an elder in your family.
Dr. Darrow, do you think that that's because some of our elders, the experience they've had, I realized this was my grandmother too, and I spent mm-hmm. a lot of time with her. Her life was not something that she wanted to talk about.
Exactly.
And she'd say, why are you talking about that old stuff? Why do you want to know that old stuff? Because it was a lot of African-American people, not just exclusive to my grandmother, have lived through Jim Crow, lived through,
they know, were painful experiences, yeah. and they don't want to recall that pain. Mm-hmm. But one of the reasons why we suffer the way we do mm-hmm. emotionally, physically, and psychologically is because we don't release the pain. Mm. We hold on to the mm-hmm. pain. And holding on to pain creates inner distress. Mm-hmm. That inner distress evolves into
disease.
Mm-hmm. It evolves into shortened lifespans. Maladaptive behaviors. We have to look at what is the pain mm-hmm. and address the pain. So, no, our grandparents and our elders may not want to talk about mm-hmm. it, but in helping them to share your story. Mm-hmm. with me. I just want to know a little bit more about, mm-hmm. you know, how you grew up, where you grew up. You know, it does give them some relief mm-hmm. and release, and it also deposits in you those things that are valuable that you need to hold on to mm-hmm. and begin to teach our children and others in the community. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of things that we have lost. One, because they've been taken away from us, mm-hmm. but two, because we've not gone to look for them. Mm. You know, you take something from me.
But I think until recently, it's been, I'm sorry, I don't want to, mm-hmm. but I think until recently, I think it's been, success has been equated with distancing. Mm-hmm. And so to prove that I'm successful, I have to remove myself from the community and prove that I'm different and I'm not like
other. But we've learned that. We've mm-hmm. learned that from Europeans.
Exactly.
They are a very individualistic mm-hmm. society.
It doesn't work with African American people.
We are a collective, mm-hmm. and we've always been a communal people. Mm-hmm. So why would my distancing help me? Mm-hmm. It's not going to help me at all. What it's going to do is remove me from the source of strength and support mm-hmm. that has helped me to go from point A to point B.
You know, it's so funny. It's like if you've ever worked in any predominantly African-American office, as hard as you try, everyone becomes family. You will try so hard not to.
It's like, but I'm going home to my own little abode.
Yeah.
You come together.
You do.
Mm-hmm. In community.
People mm-hmm. start becoming your cousins that weren't your yeah. cousins.
My children asked me the other day, they said, well, how is such and such and such and such and such and such our cousins? It don't matter. They're your cousins. Don't worry about it. They're your cousins. They come to your birthday party every year. We have cookouts. They're your cousins.
We're all connected. Mm-hmm. When we have, getting back to the School of Social Work, we have a communal area. And I think you know that. Where faculty come together and we have lunch. And we call it the lunch table. And we will come together and we will have conversations.
Y'all have some amazing food over there. I remember I came to see Professor yeah. Richie. Y'all had some chicken and y'all shared it with me.
We have amazing conversations. And those conversations are restorative. Those conversations are educational. Those conversations are therapeutic. Those conversations are supportive. Those conversations are necessary. But when we begin to grow, we tend to sometimes move away from the communal aspect mm-hmm. because everybody is doing their own thing mm-hmm. and it's necessary for us to focus. Well, I can focus just as well around that table, because I can leave that table with an idea that maybe was kind of buried before I sat down with the group to have a meal together.
So what do you say to people who feel like they don't leave by choice, but when you become, you know, successful to whatever extent that would make somebody feel like they should leave, sometimes you become hated but within your own community because of your success? We have that crab in a barrel where I'll pull you down mentality versus, hey, you know what, let me support, let me respect what you got going on, let's work together. We like to tear each other down.
You know,
you fault somebody like, you know what, I'm not dealing with that. I'm just going to...
Those sayings are often very negative. We have the crab in a barrel mentality. Where did that come from? Mm. Who taught us that?
Yeah, sometimes. So we are judged in that... from the behaviors that we've been, that has been instilled us, the mentality that has been.
Because the thought is that there's not enough.
Exactly. Primarily because I'm going to give you this much, but I'll give this one this much, and I give this one this much. Instead of us looking to see how we are being manipulated, we feed into the manipulation. Mm. And we become what they say we are. Mm-hmm. I don't consider myself a crab in a barrel. What I consider myself is, if I get to this point, my responsibility and my desire is to reach back to help somebody else up. Mm-hmm. So when you look at a crab in a barrel, they are pulling one another up to get out of the barrel. Mm-hmm. Instead of pulling each other down to bring them down in the barrel.
We don't see things for what they are. We see things for how we are.
For how we are. Or for how we are told, you know, we are.
Amazing. I've never looked at the crab in a barrel. When you look at that visual, I've never looked at it. It's the same thing happening. If somebody's reaching up, and if somebody, it's like a line of three people, and one is at the top, and we've always assumed that that person is being brought down.
Right.
Versus from that a strength-based perspective, which I've also learned.
Is trying to get out that barrel.
And he's trying to pull other people
so
out.
So if I can get out the barrel, I'm going to bring you up out the barrel with
That's
me.
That's powerful. I've never looked at it that way.
And it's not always just monetarily. It is now. Think Chris and I, entrepreneurs, but the things that we've learned, we didn't have anyone to teach us these things. So, you have to go 10 times. I mean, you have to learn a lot more. You have to figure out these resources.
Trials and error,
a lot of stuff. And you think about how much quicker you could have gotten there if you'd had someone to lay out the blueprint for you.
And that's
so
what
the
we,
knowledge you take when you leave the hood, you take the knowledge with you.
And that's what we do with other agencies, with BTFC. Mm-hmm. We have other, like, sister and brother agencies that we mentor, that they come to us for different things. We have, believe it or not, we have a ton of other agencies that provide the same service that we do, that refer their clients to us for a service that they don't have and don't feel threatened that we're trying to take their people or anything like that. But then we let them know, hey, when you work with us, you're more than a referral source. We believe and want to see you succeed. So, hey, here's the thing. Let's help you here. How are you doing this?
Right.
And you know Rashid. Mm-hmm. Rashid has an organization, and somebody asked me, like, yo, how, you just help him just like that? And I'm like, yes, but what I asked him to do, he asked me to try to help him initially. I said, hey, I can help you out with this. I can tell you exactly how this is done. But I want you to come understudy for a little bit so that you can get a real understanding of what the practice looks like versus just the verbiage.
Mm-hmm.
But then also with that, my mentality is, hey, right now we are doing okay, you know? But there may be a time when we're not. But if I can pour into Rashid and help him and help his organization grow, his season is going to come. Mm-hmm. And when his season comes, I might be at a loss in that season. So maybe he has a waiting list and can send people my way.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And this is no shade to anyone else, but I can't go to the University of Johns Hopkins or Kennedy Krieg or University of Maryland and say, hey, can you refer us your waitlist clients?
Mm-hmm.
They don't feel that same level of attachment and connection.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And and plus I know this brother's going to do good work.
Exactly. And I think that's the key point. It's not just the attachment and connection to BTST, but it's also seeing another person who has a passion for the community.
That's right.
And genuinely has a heart to help the community.
So that brings me to my point about the family focus. I know that is one of your things, and I know urban youth and families. We talked about urban and we talked about the youth part. Talk to me about why the family perspective and component is so important for you.
I think it's important for me because you cannot work with a child, a young person, outside of the family unit they're connected with. Whether that family unit is, in our estimation, a functional unit or not, we have to understand that that child is going to leave your care to go home.
Yes.
And so whatever work that you've tried to help that child with, if you don't support him in him or her in that family unit, is going to be for naught. Mm-hmm. So the family has to be supported. The family has to be encouraged. The family has to be brought along as much as you can, but you're strengthening the individual in the family. Mm. So if you're giving the individual the tools that they need to operate within that family unit, that individual is going to go back and hopefully teach that to someone else, strengthen someone else. But they themselves are strengthened enough that if they have to make the decision to, this is not working for me, and I've got to step outside of this and maybe I'm with extended family members, you know, kinship unit, that's fine. But you you cannot just take one person, it goes back to the crab in the barrel. Mm-hmm. If I take the one crab out that's trying to get out and put the lid on the other ones, then they're lost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I've got that one crab and I'm getting ready to cook him anyway.
Mm-hmm. Hey.
You know, I've taken the one person out.
Little does he know.
Little does he know what he's stepping into. Hopefully he's going to be nurtured. Hopefully he's going to be strengthened. And that's one of the things that I really think happens in an HBCU.
Mm-hmm.
That definitely people come to an HBCU and they get a source of nourishment and strengthening and encouragement that you do not get in a PWI.
It's so true.
We had State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby on last week, and she was saying the same thing, that she's from Massachusetts. And she went to, like, one of the most, she was a charter student in, like, one of the most richer counties and affluent counties in Massachusetts. But when she wound up going to Tuskegee because she wanted that HBCU experience. She wanted to be around that to get those different experiences. Really quickly, I know we've been going for a while. So you have your doctorate. Jada's been thinking about getting her doctorate, and I'm like, no, we need to focus on what our mission is. Let's work.
That's a list. I can't get my PhD.
Uh-huh.
I cannot have another baby. What I can't go out of the country for too long.
Do not send the whole Me Too movement after me thinking that I'm like being discriminatory.
No, this is for everybody else. This is exclusive to Jada McCray.
Well, she's that valuable that we both need to. And it's not just her that I'm saying that I'm locked into.
That would make her more valuable. It's interesting.
No, I'm just kidding.
It's interesting that you bring that up. I'm working on a project with a colleague now, and the name of our project is Autumn Divas, and we're looking at working with women or interviewing women who have achieved a PhD beyond the age of 50. And
well, Jada, you can fit in there, can't you?
I got a couple years left.
But the whole point of this is that you never stop learning.
Mm-hmm.
You never stop growing. And when you stop learning and stop growing, you start getting stagnant.
Mm-hmm.
And when you get stagnant, you just kind of, you lose it.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at Eric Erickson's stages of development, he talks about generativity and stagnation. And you get to a certain age and you're like, you know, being all productive and you're doing all of these things. To arrive where?
To arrive where?
At stagnation?
Mm.
No. To arrive at a point at which you can reinvent yourself however many ways you choose to. Getting an additional degree not only means the degree, but it what comes with the experience of achieving that, the perseverance it takes to do that, the education, the learning, the skill set. What you come away with, you then begin to broaden that, and it broadens you, and you then are able to share some other things with other people.
Gotcha.
So don't put that limit.
No,
on her.
She wants to
I'm
do
not
it.
I'm not one I for ceilings anyway. He knows that.
She wants to do it. And I was telling her, I said, if you go to get your doctorate, if you go anywhere except for Morgan State University, we're gonna have some internal issues around here. So just to conclude, what excites you about the future of social work?
What excites me about
because
the
we were
future,
talking about
the young people.
The young, mm-hmm. Oh, you said the young people?
Yes, the young people. It they really do. When I go to my classes and I see students come in, and you know they are so I need to learn this. I need to pass this. I need to write this paper. I need to do this. And I'm like, okay, all of that is important, and yes, you do need to do that. But what I need to see is the light go on. Mm. What I need to see is the passion ignited. What I need to see is the desire that you're going to take what you have learned and you're going to do something with it. Mm. You're not just going to take it and say, okay, I've got
this
master's and
mm-hmm.
I'm done.
Check. Mm-hmm.
Right, just check that off the mm-hmm. list and I, you know, keep it moving. What do you intend to do with this? And whose life do you intend to impact as a result
of
it?
Oh, say it again. I love it.
You know, mm-hmm. I can't say that going to school for me it's just been about getting the education. The education is important. Yes, the education has helped me to arrive at a certain point. Mm-hmm. But I want someone's life to be changed. Mm-hmm. I want someone to live a better life. I want someone to understand that they too can bring about a change and make life better for somebody else.
Mm-hmm. Mm. That's awesome. And I totally agree. And that's, you know, been a fundamental practice of things that we've built BTST on. And honestly, one of the things I wish that I would have actually taken school a little bit even more serious. Mm-hmm. Like when just sitting here talking, I'm like, Dad, majority of the education that I've received, I've gotten this one class. Imagine if I would have really taken the rest of this class and the rest of them. Even, but I did start taking them more seriously because I found it very interesting. But just imagine if I really wanted to just like overly apply myself mm-hmm. in that program. And when we talk about the stages of development, Erikson and Freud, I've learned those there. Like a majority of the basis of my education comes from you, and I greatly appreciate that. And I'll go on public record and say that I apologize for not being as easy as I should have been, because you were impacting and changing my life so that I could change someone else's.
Well, you know, the challenges that I receive or the challenges I encounter in the classroom from students sharpens me. There's a scripture in the Bible that says iron sharpens iron. Mm. So that iron doesn't always come from people who are more advanced or more experienced than I. That iron also comes from those who are coming into the classroom who think they know it all.
So basically you're saying I sharpened you a little. I made you be able to deal with the next hard head a little easier.
You know, she asked the Lord for patience. She didn't know he was going to bring Chris Simon over.
He gave me grace.
Test me, Lord. I don't want to get to this stagnant part of my career.
Lord, help me with long suffering.
Send a carry, Lord. Yeah. Well, thank you, Dr. Darrell, for coming on. I feel like we got to do this again. It's a lot more that we can talk about. Mm-hmm. And then also, I can't wait that we can actually do some stuff together to impact some more lives. So once again, I'm signing off. This is Chris Simon.
And I'm Jada McCray.
And this is our podcast meeting where you are. Thank you. Move.